Hey everybody, how the hell are you? Welcome to the show. I'm Scott Horton. And I'm yelling because I'm trying to make up for the fact that I haven't had enough coffee at all today. So I figure if I force the sound like I've got some energy, then it'll sound like I've got some energy. You know what they say, attitude follows behavior. Ah, I'm excited. Radio, yay. You know, once upon a time when I did radio, I'd get nervous. I'd be so nervous. And this lasted for years. I mean, even after I was doing the daily show, especially back when I was only on once a week, but even for years into doing the daily show, I would be so nervous in the last couple of minutes before I went on the air. I didn't really notice when that finally went away. At some point, I noticed that it had finally gone away. Man, I used to be so nervous before the show. And it would always go away as soon as I went on. I know I don't have the deepest voice, and I know I'm not the most professional or the best educated when it comes to radio, when it comes to foreign policy. But I am right about everything, and so there's that. You know, like if ever I have to listen to an old show and I go, oh man, I really screwed up right there. I called the 1990s the 1980s and then I kept on going. I didn't even hear the terrible mistake, which people in the audience must have been rolling their eyes and slapping their head and saying, what an idiot. But you know what? Still, I'm right about everything. I mean, except maybe what you called a decade, right? I actually screw up like that a lot. People freak out, man. People say that that Benazir Bhutto must have meant Osama when she said that Sheikh whatever murdered Osama. But she clearly meant to say Daniel Pearl. This is just one famous example of famous misstatements. She clearly meant to say Daniel Pearl. If she was talking about Osama, she wouldn't have used the word murdered. She wanted Osama dead as much as anybody in the world. And by the way, she was talking about Khalid Sheikh Mohammed's butt boy, the guy that killed Daniel Pearl. Now you're trying to tell me that Khalid Sheikh Mohammed's butt boy killed Osama? That doesn't even make any sense at all. Yeah, right. KSM's little Smithers murdered Osama. It makes no sense in context. And then, of course, they said, well, and that's why the CIA killed her. No, the CIA was in the middle of putting her back in power. That's what's fun about being a truther. You don't have to know anything about the world at all. You just grab onto whatever sounds good. Oh, yeah, she accidentally told the truth on TV when she made an obvious misstatement, and that's why the people who were in the middle of putting her back in power bombed her to death, huh? Anyway, one time on the show, I called for Glenn Greenwald to be executed. I really did. But the thing is, I love Glenn Greenwald. I think Glenn Greenwald is the best. And if anybody says anything bad about Glenn Greenwald, I'll fight you. I wasn't talking about Glenn Greenwald at all. I was talking about Paul Wolfowitz. And in fact, I think what had happened was Greenwald had written a thing about Wolfowitz. And it had really pissed me off. And so I was yelling and screaming about Wolfowitz. And I was saying, that guy ought to be hanged. But I said Greenwald when I meant to say Wolfowitz. And I didn't even notice. I didn't even hear the word Wald in my ear ringing and telling me, hey, man, you just said Greenwald when you meant to say Wolfowitz. Didn't even notice. Until later. You know, like that time Benazir Bhutto accidentally said Osama bin Laden when she meant to say Daniel Pearl, who was, of course, the subject of the discussion in that interview. But anyway. But I like cherry picking whatever tiny little factoids out of context to mean whatever I want them to mean. Scott, why are you pissing all over my parade, man? Anyway. I misspeak a lot, but, you know, the things that I'm actually trying to say, I'm right about everything. Everything. And oftentimes I read other people's articles and I go, man, this is great. He got exactly right. This is what I said 6 months ago or a year ago. And, of course, nobody ever gives me credit. No one ever says, yeah, just like Scott Horton was saying 6 months ago. You know why? Because nobody listens to the show except you. That's why they never quote me. It's not because I haven't been right before everyone. I'm way ahead of the curve, man. I even told you Obama didn't want to bomb Syria a few weeks back. Told you he was going to try to find a way out of it, didn't I? I'm even good on predicting peace when my business is predicting war. Even when I misspeak, I'm right about everything. So it doesn't matter that I don't have the world's deepest voice. I wish I did. You know, my Uncle Sig had the best voice ever. You know, he was the voice, actually. He was the announcer on the classical music station down in San Antonio for 40 years or 50 years or something. I ought to contact them and see if I can get some audio. And, you know, I was doing radio when he was still alive, and I always meant to see if I could get him to say, "You're listening to Scott Horton," or whatever. And his voice made James Earl Jones sound like the squeaky voice teen on The Simpsons. His voice was 1,000 times deeper and cooler than James Earl Jones's voice. It was so awesome. Best radio voice probably that Baby Jesus ever invented. You know, gave to a man to use. My uncle's sick. Nah, not me. I mean, my voice, it's not all that squeaky, right? Occasionally. But it's okay because I'm right about everything. All right. Well, anyway, so Ollie Grebe will be on the show today, and he'll say a bunch of things I already told you. Brendan O'Neill will be on the show. Brendan O'Neill's better than me on everything. He's smarter than I am. He just remembers stuff better. I used to be better. I think I'm actually getting worse at this now that I think about it. Like, the O'Neill article that made me want to invite him on, I realize now is a couple of weeks old. I'm sure he's written other stuff since, but that's okay. He'll have plenty to say, but his Syria article, it's really good for counting off at what different points America and Britain made the situation in Syria worse. And he gets it date by date correct. And that's important. I should have that. I should be as good as Brendan O'Neill on that. I should be saying, yeah, well, you know, it was a protest movement until April the 23rd, 2011, or whatever the damn date was, when Obama ruined everything for them. Here, I'm taking a note. I was going to say something, but then I thought, nah, I should wait until the Brendan O'Neill interview and talk about it with him. So now, I'm writing a note so that I won't forget. All right. I am Scott Horton. This is my radio show. I'm not just going to sit here wasting time, blah, blah, blahing the whole show. I've got three great interviews coming up. Oh, I forgot to mention Mark Hyden is going to be here. Mark Hyden is, get this, he's from a group called Conservatives Concerned. Is it about the death penalty or capital punishment? I forgot. About the death penalty. Conservatives Concerned about the death penalty. Questioning a system marked by inefficiency, inequity, and inaccuracy. Man, you know what? I'll tell you, right-wingers sure are better when left-wingers are in power. Well, in some ways they're worse, but in some ways they're a lot better. Like on foreign policy and on the death penalty. I mean, foreign policy is really my biggest issue, and I guess I prefer the right-wing in power for that because they're not really any worse in their actions and activities. I guess they're a little bit worse in what they do. They are. I don't think Al Gore would have done the Iraq War, not the way Bush did it anyway. And just look at how much worse Romney and McCain are on Israel issues, and that includes, of course, Syria and Iran issues, than Obama has been. And Obama's horrible, but just think how much worse he could be if he was John McCain instead, you know? So maybe the Republicans are worse on foreign policy, but at least when they are, you can find a gigantic anti-war movement that hates their guts and is willing to work all day against them and exposing them and whatever, whatever. It just kills me. It hurts my little bitty feelings. The way liberals give up on peace when Democrats are in power, at least the way they have up until this Syria thing. It's just, it's sad. It's embarrassing. And, you know, you got to figure when Jeb Bush, he'll have to be in power for a few years before the left-wing anti-war movement can get back into gear, right? Unless they really get into gear now. Which, guys, there's Afghan, Pakistan, Yemen, Somalia, Libya, Syria, Iran. There's plenty of conflict for you to oppose if you want to get started now. Because, you know, if you wait until the Republicans come back into power, nobody's going to want to hear it from you for a few years. We're just going to laugh in your face. Oh, yeah, right, like you're anti-war. Where have you been for 8 years? Now that Jeb Bush is the president, you're anti-war, huh? They'll all say. In fact, that's what I said in 2002. And in 2003, I was like, you liberals aren't anti-war. Listen to you. Give the UN inspectors more time. The UN doesn't have the authority to tell Iraq whether they can have mustard gas or not. This whole thing is a crock. Give the inspectors more time. And then what? If they find a centrifuge, then kill them all? Give the inspectors more time. In other words, if it was Bill Clinton and Al Gore doing this, you'd be fine with it. As long as they emphasize that this is for the Iraqi people's own good. They wouldn't even need the UN, right? They could do just like Serbia and just use NATO, a coalition of the willing. And the liberals didn't have a leg to stand on opposing George Bush's war. Not really, because they had supported all of Bill Clinton's wars. Same kind of thing here. Although, you know, Clinton's wars, as horrible as they were, I mean, he killed 1 million Iraqis. 1 million civilians. Which makes him a villain on the order of Harry Truman or Saddam Hussein or some kind of monster like that. But it was all blockade. He just starved them quietly to death. Like Obama in Somalia, you know? He didn't bomb them all to death right off the face of the earth. And so, it passed for peacetime, the Clinton years, right? The 1990s. The worst thing he ever did was lie about some oral sex, I heard. And so the contrast when Bush came into power and all of a sudden hippies were willing to criticize American foreign policy again, it didn't. Their hypocrisy didn't stink quite as bad because the whole society was basically ignorant of all the violence that Bill Clinton had been waging against the planet. But if they don't get started now, but they want to, you know, start speaking up once the Republicans come back into power, that's going to really be a problem after 8 years of Obama-led mass murder. You know, where he's replicated what Bill Clinton did to Iraq just in Somalia. Never even mind his surge, escalation, and prolonging of the war in Afghanistan by years. And 10,000 deaths are probably a hell of a lot more than that. And escalation into Pakistan, into Yemen. The war in Libya against Gaddafi. For the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group and the Ansar al-Sharia and al-Qaeda in Iraq. Who then spread the war to Mali, back to Syria, and wherever else. And his attempted war in Syria. I mean, this has been a foreign, he's a war president, this Barack Obama. There just ain't no denying, like there was denying under Bill Clinton. So, anyway, sorry I'm off on a double extra tangent. I was just trying to make the point that I like liberals better when conservatives are in power. I like conservatives better when liberals are in power. And can you imagine conservatives concerned about the death penalty when the Republicans are the ones running the government in D.C.? And of course, never even mind who runs the state governments where 90% of all the executions are carried out, probably more than that, right? It's just like, I remember there was a survey, a study done right after, in 2002 or something that said that the conviction rate across the country in all jurisdictions after September 11th went way, way up. And the conviction rate already is probably average at 97% or something, right? So they just went up to 100%. Boy, if the cops say you did it, then you did it, because we're at war. It doesn't matter what the charge is. And in fact, there's something I'll never get over. All the conspiracy stuff about inside job or prior knowledge or whatever, not to the side for the moment. Just the psychology of the official story as accepted by virtually everyone at the time. you know, in raw numbers of the population, 99%. This thing happened on George W. Bush's watch. There were almost 24 real ass Al-Qaeda in the country for a year and a half. Training in American flight schools. Hijacked American planes from American airports. Crashed them into American targets. And George Bush's approval rating went through the roof. He'd been the president for 9 months at the time. That's plenty long enough that he should have been doing his job by then. And Bill Clinton, of course, they should have both been strung up. Louis Freeh and the leadership at the FBI, at the Department of Justice, at the CIA, these people should have all been hanging from trees after September 11th. George Tenet, who we now know went to extraordinary lengths to keep the FBI and even the White House ignorant of the San Diego cell, the guys that ended up piloting Flight 77 into the Pentagon, these guys should have been strung up for their failure to prevent that attack. And instead, it turned into absolute super duper majority approval for the government and anything it wanted to do. How does that work? You know? What if they had let the British Army build up in Canada and roll on into Vermont? Would we have given them, would we have supported DC? I mean, obviously in their war against Britain, we'd prefer that. We'd support them to the Brits, probably. I don't know. At this point, I might settle for the Brits, but, Would we give our approval rating to the president that let them build up their force in Canada and roll in and fail to stop them at the border? I don't know. That was a bad example, but it just seems like I don't understand the psychology of that, really. You know? The worst failure of any American politician ever since FDR failed to keep us out of World War II. Which is a funny way of saying ever since he succeeded in getting us into it. But anyway. And that equaled highest approval rating ever. Liberals, conservatives, everybody else. Anyway. Juries across the country, their confidence in prosecutors and judges went through the roof. After September 11th. Their just overall emotional bond with the state was strengthened by 100 times. Doesn't matter that these things have nothing to do with each other other than just all cops are heroes, right? Anyway, so here's something that's been invented called conservatives concerned about the death penalty. I'm going to try to be like mean but polite at the same time. I don't want to fight with this guy. I think this is a great project, and I think that you know, they deserve a lot of credit for pursuing it and whatever, but he's the one calling himself conservatives here, and I got to kind of question whether this makes any sense at all. I mean, conservatives concerned about the rights of the innocent? Conservatives concerned about anybody but themselves. I don't know. Only with Democrats in power, that's for sure. Oh, good. I just got an email from Patrick Coburn. He travels around a lot. Still working on it, but we'll have him on the show probably tomorrow or the next day to talk about Libya. Man, he's been writing some insane stuff about Libya. All right, I'm sorry, I'm talking too much. I should be covering the news here. I spent a good 20 minutes talking just about who's going to be on the show. Oh, and straight into the break, too. FFF.org, Council for the National Interest.org. All right. See, I told you I suck at this. I'm good about everything, but I'm good on every issue, but I'm terrible at being a radio show host. I spent 20 minutes talking about what's going to be on the show today and then whatever tangent popped into my head. I warned you, I haven't had any coffee, man. I'm on my second cup now. I'm not feeling it. Anyway, I'm Scott Horton. This is the show. The U.S. is to blame. The U.S. government is to blame for Somalia's misery. That's my article in the Future of Freedom. And I just talked over their commercial break. FFF.org/subscribe is how you get their journal, The Future of Freedom. Basically, you know, they publish stuff every day. Great stuff. They're at FFF.org. But their very best stuff goes in the journal, The Future of Freedom, edited by Sheldon Richman. And so in the September issue is my article, U.S. Government to Blame for Somalia's Misery. Now, the thing of that is, I emailed Jacob and I said, would you please post that on the website because there's big Somalia news going on and Eric Garris over at antiwar.com wants to link to it and et cetera like that. And Jacob Hornberger was gracious enough to go ahead and publish this article early. Usually you would have to be a subscriber to see this thing for the next few months before it would go online for everyone. So he's been very generous in going ahead and publishing the whole thing online. You can find the link on my Facebook page, U.S. Government to Blame for Somalia's Misery. And then my editor, Sheldon Richman, our good friend, vice president of the Future Freedom Foundation, he wrote his weekly article about the attack on the mall in Kenya and its relation to America's war in Somalia, and then quoted my article at length about it, too. So that's sort of the update to my article, you know, combining the very recent news of the attack of this last week. It lasted 4 days, 5 days or something, 4 days, at the mall in Nairobi, Kenya. So my article, again, at FFF.org, is U.S. Government to Blame for Somalia's Misery. And then Sheldon Richman's follow-up is called The Kenyan Massacre's Roots in America's Somalia Policy. And I've told this story a lot of times. I don't get sick of telling it because I know most people don't know it. I told this story yesterday to Ernie Hancock. If you go to scotthorton.org and just look on the stress blog there, you can see embedded video of my interview with Ernest Hancock yesterday, where I think that's probably the best single sit down and tell it as fast as you can kind of telling that I've given of the history of America's Somalia policy that I've ever done. And it worked on Ernie. And I know that because Ernie basically recounted all back to me. He goes, okay, so well, what we know is, and then he repeated the entire story in, you know, very shorthand. But in other words, it stuck. I wasn't just babbling. Apparently, it made sense. This is what's going on there. This is why it's all the American Empire's fault. And this is the context in which you need to look at what's happening at the mall in Nairobi this week. And now, a Facebook friend sent me a link to NPR, like I guess a Washington, D.C. Affiliate NPR station, like a local, not their nationwide network, but a local NPR type show where he, first of all, is taking calls from Kenyans and Somalis in the audience. But then he also had an expert on from, I don't know, the Brookings Institution or something like that. And she was an expert on Somalia. And, I mean, you know, call it bias, but all I heard was confirmation of what I've been saying there. And in fact, she sounded very nice and very polite. And all of the premises unstated and stated by the host were pretty, you know, bland. And she was pretty tough. You know, he would say, well, geez, were the Kenyans able to convince the Americans to pay for this? And she's like, look, America's behind all this, okay? America's paying for all of this. America has been paying for all this. all along. This is not a matter of them getting America to help. This is a matter of America getting them to help, kind of thing. And anyway, so all of my biases were confirmed. All of my information was deemed correct by this lady, sounded like to me. And so I was reinforced in thinking, okay, good. I guess I haven't screwed up too bad about what's going on here. And the reason why, it isn't because I've ever been to Somalia, and because I know the first thing about Somalia, other than I've been keeping track of what America's been doing to Somalia since at least 2005, since before the Ethiopian invasion and regime change. And so, you know, I just remember what's been going on. And I've paid close attention to the few sources that there are out there about it. But anyway, so if you want the background, if you want to know why everything horrible in Somalia is all America's fault, all George Bush and Barack Obama's fault, read my article at fff.org today. It's also my Facebook page, my Twitter page there. It's called U.S. Government to Blame for Somalia's Misery. And now, man, I'm sorry because I've got no time whatsoever, and then nothing but three interviews later in the show today. Let me just mention, I mentioned Patrick Coburn. He's got these Libya stories we're going to talk with him about. We've got the NSA review panel is littered with insiders, of course. There's a great article by John Neffel, our friend John Neffel, in Rolling Stone about the FBI that I want to try to catch up with him about. I need to write that down, Neffel, John. I like that guy. I think, isn't it him that, it's him and his sister both are really good on stuff and do a radio show together and write good things. I forget her name. What am I missing here? What I wanted to talk with you about. Oh, I guess it was just going to be serious stuff. I wanted to talk about the different reports about the Mujahideen in Syria and the different battles between the FSA and the ISIS, whatever else they call themselves. I guess we'll save all that for the Brendan O'Neill interview anyway. That'll be all right. Anyway, I'll just tell you now, it's the new and improved ScottHorton.org. Go and check it out at ScottHorton.org. Got a built-in chat room there for you to hang out and talk with the people. Stress blog's up and going again. And, ScottHorton.org, ScottHorton.org, ScottHorton.org. Yeah. And I'm on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at /ScottHortonShow. And we'll be right back with Ali Gharib on Iran in just a sec. All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. I'm waiting on a number to call. Hey, Ali, send me your number, dude. Ali Gharib's going to be on the show again, everybody. It's been, I don't know, man, a couple of years, I think, since I interviewed him. Ask me, hey, Scott, why has it been a couple of years since you've talked with Ali Gharib on the show? Answer, I have no idea. Why has it been so long? I like Ali Gharib, though. He writes good stuff. Writes for the Daily Beast nowadays. Here's his piece in Al Jazeera, the U.S. and Iran, the art of the nuclear deal. Of course, the big news from yesterday is that Obama and Rouhani did not meet. And I hate Barack Obama. You suck, dude. Remember back during the debate, they said, hey, would you meet with Mahmoud Ahmadinejad without preconditions? And he goes, yeah, I would. If I'm the president of the United States, I got all the self-esteem in the world that I need to go ahead and meet with a pipsqueak like him. You know, Cheney claimed that it was like an honor to some despot if the Americans would even meet with them. Oh, we can't meet with the Iranians. That's like bestowing all of, you know, Dick Cheney and the American Empire's legitimacy onto them. We can't have that. And Obama was like, that's stupid. Yeah, I'll meet with whoever. If we can work something out, wouldn't you rather work something out than have a war? Come on. And then he has his chance to meet with Rouhani yesterday, and what does he do? Well, you know, they're blaming it all on Rouhani. But if you hear the Iranians tell it, which I believe the Iranians 100 times more than the worst evil liar murderers in the whole world, the U.S. government, and their version is that the Democrats put so many conditions on how this meeting was to take place that they decided screw it. And of course, Obama's speech was full of a bunch of screw yous anyway, which, you know, changed the atmosphere of the whole thing. If I hear one more person say atmospherics, I'm going to choke the life out of them. Atmospherics. Who the hell coined that? I wish George Carlin was alive. Anyway, Obama was a jerk about it in his speech in the first place. And then they put so many conditions on the meeting that the Iranians decided, well, screw it then, if that's how you're going to be. And they did not meet. Now, you know, the object wasn't for them to work out everything at lunch. It was simply for the one president to meet the other and shake hands and say, hey, look, we're shaking hands. That's it. That's it. And Barack Obama, subhuman piece of crap, blew it. Again. Just like everything. Oh, hey, a number to call. All right. We're 6 minutes late here, but that's all right. Well, here, let me find a song to play for you. If I can. Note to future radio show guests. I need your phone number, unless you're stopping by the house, which I'll hook up Mike too for you if you want. But otherwise, I'm going to need a phone number. All right, hang on a second. Oh, man, that's not it. Hey, y'all, Scott here. Man, I had a chance to have an essay published in the book Why Peace, edited by Mark Gutman, but I didn't understand what an opportunity it was. Boy, do I regret I didn't take it. This compendium of thoughts by the greatest anti-war writers and activists of our generation will be remembered and studied long into the future. You've got to get Why Peace. You've got to read Why Peace. It features articles by Harry Brown, Robert Naiman, Fred Bronfman, Dahlia Wasfey, Richard Cummings, Karen Katowski, Butler Schaefer, Kathy Kelly, Robert Higgs, Anthony Gregory, and so many more. Why peace? Because war is the health of everything wrong with our society. Get Why Peace. Down at the bookshop or Amazon.com. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org.
Why does the U.S. support the tortured dictatorship in Egypt? Because that's what Israel wants. Why can't America make peace with Iran? Because that's not what Israel wants. And why do we veto every attempt to shut down illegal settlements on the West Bank? Because it's what Israel wants. Seeing a pattern here? Sick of it yet? It's time to put America first. Support the Council of the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org and push back against the Israel lobby and their sock puppets in Washington, D.C. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
Aw, man. Thanks a lot, Rancid, for ruining the punchline on that Richard Pryor bit. You suck. I guess maybe there's a setting I was supposed to hit so that it wouldn't do that. That's just enough for the cite. Yeah, really funny when it's me and not Richard Pryor saying it anyway. Alright, well, whatever. It's the radio show. Hey, I'm Scott Horton. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Our first guest today is Ollie Garib. And last I checked, he's writing for the Daily Beast. But here he is at Al Jazeera, America.AlJazeera.com, U.S. and Iran, the art of the nuclear deal. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing?
I'm well, thanks. It's a pleasure to be here, Scott.
Yeah, it's been way too long since we've talked. I don't know whatever happened to you coming on the show and me talking to you all the time, but anyway.
Yeah, it has been a while. I've just been busy, but here I am.
All right. Well, hey, thanks for writing good stuff all the time. I still read you all the time, even if I don't ask you questions about it all the time. U.S. and Iran, the art of the nuclear deal, as you say here, the diplomatic solution requires concessions from both sides, but making them may be tougher for Obama. Why is that?
Well, they both have a lot of pockets of domestic opposition to what they're trying to do, both being Obama and the Iranian president, Hassan Rouhani, and to the extent that he's behind Rouhani, Iran's supreme leader, Ali Khamenei. They're hardliners in both countries, and you know, if Rouhani can manage to get the supreme leader behind him in any concessions he wants to make, then that's sort of a done deal. Khamenei has the final say on matters of state, including and especially the nuclear program. Now, Rouhani says that he's been delegated the authority to cut a deal on this stuff, and if that's the case and he does cut a deal, then imposing it is as simple as Khamenei saying, okay, these are the changes we must make to our nuclear program. You know, we're talking about a one-man show here. Now, there are some legitimate questions about whether that will happen, because Khamenei is shrewd and fickle, and we don't know if he'll actually back down on some of the concessions that would be that I outlined that would be required of Iran. Now, all that said, Obama is facing a different thing, because the Iranians' key concerns revolve around the sanctions program that's leveled against their country. The International Crisis Group did a study of the sanctions. There's 31 different measures in effect, and only 8 of them are imposed by executive order and have not been codified by the Congress. And then there's a host of other institutions that have made these sanctions programs against Iran. They've taken these measures. One would be the European Union. Another is the UN Security Council. Those sanctions, the ones codified by Congress, the ones from the EU and the ones from the UN Security Council, will be much, much harder to permanently reverse, because they take more than just one man's vote. In the case of the EU, it needs to be agreed by consensus that the sanctions should be reversed. The UN Security Council would need to issue more resolutions to undo the old ones. And Congress, likewise, will need to legislate away the sanctions that exist. Now, in some of those congressionally legislated sanctions, there are opportunities for Obama to use waivers, but the Iranians aren't going to view that as a very concrete concession. You know, anything that can be that easily reversed, this is a matter of Obama not taking a waiver on a certain set of sanctions. They're not going to view those as the sort of concessions for which they should really open up their nuclear program to the world. And, you know, as we all know, Congress is not exactly a very friendly place to Iran, and it's entirely possible that many members of Congress will balk at the prospect of legislating any kind of sanctions relief. In fact, Congress is going full steam ahead right now to try and pile on more measures against Iran, even amid this sort of very striking thaw that's happening.
Well, now, in your article, you draw the distinction between Obama's position and Netanyahu's position, that really the Democrats, since Obama took power, they have at least implicitly, I think you quote Hillary Clinton pretty directly, but they have at least implicitly all along accepted continued Iranian enrichment, just at this level, not that, and just here, not there, and that kind of thing. Whereas the Israeli position has been no nuclear anything at all, because it all might as well be an H-bomb hanging over Tel Aviv. And
yeah,
so
the Israelis want every bit of nuclear infrastructure inside Iran to be dismantled. They want all the nuclear material to be quarantined and shipped out of the country. They want to basically erase Iran's nuclear program from the pages of history, to borrow a phrase.
But then, so you're saying that that's Congress's position, and that's what Obama's up against, is if he wants to make a deal where he concedes, okay, 3.6% enrichment at Natanz, but please close Fordo and cease any enrichment up to 20%, whatever, that's not going to be good enough for Congress. He's not going to be able to say to Congress, we won, we got what we want, because Netanyahu's their president, not him.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's like there's a constellation of Iran hawks with various interests, and no doubt many of those interests are tied up with the interest of Israel via Israel's proxy in D.C., which is the sort of constellation of pro-Israel groups, especially AIPAC, which exerts a tremendous amount of influence on the Hill, although that has faltered recently too. I wouldn't be surprised if you know, AIPAC made a play to get congressional support for Obama's resolution to strike Syria. Now, Congress is well aware that Iran is a much bigger deal to AIPAC and is a much bigger deal to Israel, so they may still go along with it full tilt as they have in the past, But there's always a chance that, that Obama could peel away enough Democrats to sort of start a movement to try and repeal some of these sanctions. But basically, you're right, that, that Congress is unlikely to go along with concessions that leave any sort of Iranian enrichment capacity in place. And there's also another issue, which is that you know, the issue of even starting negotiations with the Iranians and or coming to a final agreement without having the Iranians suspend their program. Now, the UN Security Council mandates that Iran should suspend its enrichment for an undisclosed period. This is not the same as the Israeli demand that everything be dismantled and shipped out of the country, but that is, but it's still a demand that is you know, enshrined in international law by the Security Council. Even in, even under President Bush, when the U.S. joined the P5 plus one, the P5 plus one, this group of world powers that includes Russia, China, Germany, the U.K., and the U.S., and France, sent proposals to the Iranians that, you know, left open the possibility that Iran would be allowed to enrich at a later date. Since Obama's come to power, they've been much more explicit about it. But what Obama really changed, the most significant change that he made, was to eliminate preconditions. That is, Bush was unwilling to even negotiate with Iran, to sit at a table with them. The P5 plus one is floating these proposals for negotiations, but Bush, but they never happened. Bush was always and was never willing to sit down at the table with the Iranians unless they first complied with enriching, suspending enrichment. Now, that was lifted by Obama, and his administration has been much more explicit about the possibility for later Iranian enrichment, and that brought about a change in focus, where what happened was that the focus of the P5 plus one countries went not just to, you know, getting direct Iranian obedience of the Security Council resolution, but sort of working on what would be a final deal and how is the best way to get there, irrespective of whether the Iranians were to suspend enrichment at the outset or at any point in the process. And the reason for that partly is because the Iranians have become more obstinate on that point, and they refuse to suspend enrichment. It's a non-starter for them. So to say that we're waiting for Iran to suspend enrichment or insisting on it as a sticking point in negotiations would be to basically swear off any deal at all. And that is not a path, certainly, the Obama administration wants to go down.
Yeah. Well, listen, I'm happy to see any government just acknowledging reality and trying to work with it at all. I mean, like you're saying, the Bush policy was, it wasn't getting them anywhere from, you know, judging from their own goals, never mind my goals of peace, you know. But also on the question whether...
No.
Well, go ahead.
I was just going to say it'd be nice to have the Iranians comply with international law. You know, that would be a great thing, I think, for everybody.
You mean in terms of freezing the enrichment at all?
Yeah, suspending it. Suspending it in accordance with the UN Security Council resolution. That it would be a nice thing to have, but as you say, it just doesn't, it's not a realistic prospect.
Yeah, I mean, look,
it's choosing between the realistic prospect of making a deal with Iran without them suspending enrichment or going to war in order to delay Iran and create chaos in the Middle East and likely spur the Iranians into actual production of a nuclear weapon, which they're not now doing. I mean, I would say it's preferable to say, listen, we can kind of wink and nod at this one requirement of the UN Security Council resolution that we don't think it's realistic for us to set as a hard and fast condition for any negotiations.
Sure, because, I mean, after all, and look, I'm not the expert on international law, that's the other Scott, but it seems to me like the UN can go and screw itself. Then the Security Council doesn't have the right to tell Iran that they have to freeze enrichment any more than they got the right to tell you or me what to do either. They voluntarily signed the Non-Proliferation Treaty and voluntarily signed a safeguards agreement under that Non-Proliferation Treaty. And I don't know, you know, what subsection, chapter, heading, this, that, the other thing, the Americans and the Brits, and in this case, even the Russians and the Chinese think that they have the right to tell them that they have to freeze all enrichment. But if the UN Security Council, you know, lest the United States try to tell us that we have to freeze all enrichment, we would say no. In fact, we don't even live up to our obligations under the NPT to get rid of our nuclear weapons.
Not to mention that we shield Israel from any scrutiny at all over its nuclear weapons program.
Well,
which,
and also,
by
we're
the way,
bound to respect the right of the Iranians. And we don't respect the right of the Iranians like we sworn to do, too.
Well, yes, that's true, Scott. But I have to say that, you know, the right that the UN Security Council has to do those things is by majority votes, just like any, I mean, you know, what you're saying, I think, you know, I think this is probably the difference between you and me politically. While we agree on some things, you know, I am sort of a progressive who believes in the international system and believes these things are important, and that sometimes sovereignty must take a back seat to them. And I agree with you that the U.S. doesn't live up to all its expectations, and certainly not in terms of Israel. But that being said, that when the U.N. Security Council made this pronouncement in 2006 precisely because Iran had violated the terms of the Safeguards Agreement, that's what got Iran in this mess in the first place. Now, I think you can make an argument that
well, in what way? You mean just making Natanz a secret?
Sorry?
You mean just building the Natanz facility in secret? Because they hadn't introduced any nuclear material into it. What way were they in violation of the Safeguards Agreement?
Yeah, they had done some initial uranium processing and building those facilities.
Well, I mean, it was still, there's BBC pictures that they took the BBC on a tour of it in 2005. It was still a big empty space underground. Natanz.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, enrichment wasn't happening there yet, but they were getting fuel. They were acquiring all the materials and all the fuel to do it, and they were required. And you know, there was clear agreement within the international system, and I don't think, and you know, this was at a time when El Baradei was heading up the IAEA, you know, not exactly viewed as friendly by the Bush administration, and that was at a time when the Director General's report concluded that Iran was in violation of the Safeguards Agreement. That's the grounds on which the Security Council passed that resolution. And that does carry the force of international law. I mean, that's just the way it is. Like, I agree that there should be some flexibility.
I guess my understanding was that they were kind of up to the edge of illegality there, in the sense that they had created a nuclear program in secret just because the Americans wouldn't let them create one. You know, we interfered every time the Russians or the Chinese tried to sell them a power plant or anything like that, or give them any equipment. So they had to get it from AQ Khan, the underground, but then they never... You know, the deal in the Safeguards Agreement is you have to let us know 6 months before you introduce nuclear material into any machine, this, that, and the other thing. And I thought that they had not been in violation of that. But I guess maybe I don't remember back.
That's
We're talking about
the Director General of the IAEA said.
Anyway, go ahead.
I think that there's a legitimate point of disagreement here. And you know, being up to the edge of illegality, of legality rather, means that you're up to the edge of illegality. And so, you know, I think that there's room for a reasonable degree disagreement on it, and I think that the Security Council might have been a bit aggressive in demanding suspension as part of its resolution. But that said, they did it, and they did it on, you know, grounds that, you know, whether you disagree with them or not, are not completely specious. There was reason for suspicion of Iran, and Iran was indeed building a covert nuclear program at the time that its efforts were revealed by Iranian dissidents with the help of Israeli intelligence. And so, you know, I just think that I can see precisely where the UN is coming from. And either way, the Security Council has agreed to that condition on Iran. And once that happens, it carries the force of international law. You know, there are good laws and there are bad laws, and I'm all for trying to use legal processes to undo bad laws. But laws are still laws, and violating them is still violating them. And they're, you know, that. Listen, I break the law sometimes too. I speed in my car sometimes. I enjoy the occasional joint, but that doesn't mean that those things are legal, right? Like, and so I think we need to recognize what's legal and what's not, and make room for flexibility when it's available.
Sure. I guess my thing is it's so obvious, right? All along, it's been obvious that they don't really want a nuclear bomb, even one of them, as a deterrent. They want a breakout capability as a deterrent, and that's written into the NPT, basically, that everybody can have a breakout capability if they want to. And America is bound, and the rest of the UN Security Council, everybody else is bound to respect that. And a lot of people hate that and gnash their teeth about it and whatever. But that's the fact of the thing, is their threat is that, look, if you try to bomb and regime change us, then we could withdraw from the NPT and begin trying trying to make a nuke, and if we were really working hard at it and digging deep underground enough to do it, you wouldn't be able to stop us from finally coming up with a real nuclear bomb. And that's basically the position they're working for all this time, right? Is not a weapon.
I think that's a completely reasonable scenario, but, you know, I think actually it might boil down to a little, even sort of a less aggressive posture by Iran. I think that they, when they set out on this path, they did it because they did think that it would bring them some international prestige and bring them a sort of chit to cash in to gain more international legitimacy. Now, obviously that backfired and the Iranians stuck with it, and as anybody who's ever met an Iranian in their life will tell you, it's probably because Iranians are about the most damn stubborn people in the world. And they stuck with it, and it actually led to the opposite of what they'd hoped for. But I do think that they do it as a sort of an issue of prestige, to be a craw, to stick in the side of the West, and to be a thorn in the West shoe. And I don't think it's even necessarily sort of a backup plan to be at the threshold of breakout capability. I just think they want to develop that capability in order to use it to build up their own prestige, and we're hoping to use it as a chit to cash in. And it backfired, and that's why we're seeing a more conciliatory tone by them now.
I see, yeah. What's funny is it sort of goes without saying, though it shouldn't, that nobody, not even Netanyahu, believes that they would ever, you know, that they're on the path to try to build a bomb so they can use it in a first strike against Israel, which is so ridiculous, as, you know, we kind of forget to even bring it up to debunk sometimes.
Yeah, I mean, we can't really take Netanyahu here. Anybody who makes a lot of noise, you know, and this sort of goes for the pro-Israel groups in Washington as well. When you're making a lot of noise, you know, the issue we were just talking about suspension being part of a UN Security Council resolution, when you're making a lot of noise about that and talking about adherence to the law and the safeguards agreement and the nuclear nonproliferation treaty, you have to remember, as I was saying before, that Israel's the only country in the world that has a covert nuclear arsenal of between 100 and 200 missiles. That's the best estimates. We don't really know. And when it comes to nuclear weapons in the world, Israel is the one who is completely outside the international legal system. And so, yeah, there's definitely some hypocrisy there. I mean, you know, I'm sort of
in
the mind that we should be ignoring.
Too, right?
Sorry?
India and Pakistan, their nukes aren't covert, but they're outside
Right. They're outside the legal system as well, but they're declared. Yeah, you're right. You're right. I should. That was a mistake on my part. They're not the only ones outside the legal system. They're the only ones that are out, that have a covert arsenal. And so we should. I just think that we got to take a grain of salt. Everything that Bibi says. There's sort of clear pressure points that he's trying here to try and. I think Paul Pilar wrote a great piece on the national interest today. I think it's pretty clear that Bibi not only fears an Iranian nuke, but he fears one in connection with his larger fears that would be a rapprochement between the West and Iran that I don't think would be good for strategically for Israel's position. And I think that that's part I don't doubt that some of his fears of an Iranian nuclear weapon, whether well-founded or not, are genuine. But I do think that he also has great concerns about a deal and what it would mean for Israel's strategic position going forward in the region.
Right. In other words,
I mean, you know, America's Arab allies, and I don't get me wrong, I think they're unsavory allies of ours, but America's Arab allies have been enough of a headache for the Israeli right. You know, imagine what having a rapprochement and a thaw and maybe better relations between the U.S. and Iran would mean.
Right. Well, it would mean that America doesn't have any more enemies in the region. And so...
Well, as far as states are concerned, at least.
Well, and it would mean that much more pressure on the Israelis to make friends with the same countries we're friends with.
Yeah. Right? Yeah, that's true.
Well, and as Netanyahu complained to Jeffrey Goldberg in The Atlantic, Corporal Goldberg, that, hey, this could limit their freedom of action a little bit, you know? If the Iranians ever did have a nuke, not that he feared that Iran would nuke Israel, just it might be harder for Israel to invade southern Lebanon again, like they are wont to do from time to time.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, I think it's sort of a moot point because I don't think the Iranians will develop nuclear weapons until a time when
it's not quite moot because they tell the rubes on Fox News all day that, oh, you know what, they and their 12th imam will do with a nuke if they get one, which they're trying to do. And even Obama in his speech implied that they are, in fact, making nuclear bombs now.
Yeah, no, I mean, no doubt Israel is an important player. I just think that I don't know. I'm inclined these days to just sort of to sort of cast them aside in a way and view them as just a kind of guy on the sideline screaming, you know, like at football games and at baseball games, you always have these guys that sit in the seats close to the field that yell and scream their heads off. It's like, you know what? Those guys don't get to play in the game, and the Israelis aren't playing and trying to hash out a nuclear deal with Iran. They're a factor mostly only because of the hill, and as I was saying, the sanctions that need to be lifted in order to cut some kind of deal. But that's it. That's their only avenue of influence is in that way. And so I just think that we ought to not care that much, frankly, what they say. I mean, I don't want to say that they're completely unimportant, but they're just not a major player in this thing. At this point, all they are is a sort of megaphone yelling at Congress, and that our attentions are better directed at what's actually going on between the U.S., the P5 plus one, and Iran, and what sort of deal can be arrived at.
Right.
You get what I'm saying?
Yeah, absolutely. Well said. I like the sound of that. That was good. All right, we're all out of time. Thanks very much for yours. Ali Gharib at Al Jazeera America. And you still write for the Daily Beast, too?
Still writing for the Daily Beast. Yep,
okay,
I'm
good.
I'm writing up a piece right now.
All right. And follow him on Twitter, too. Be right back. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to talk to you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. In the book, Swanson explains what the revolution was, the rise of empire, and the permanent military economy. And all from a free market libertarian perspective. Jacob Hornberger, founder and president of the Future Freedom Foundation, says the book is absolutely awesome, and that Swanson's perspectives on the Cold War and the Cuban Missile Crisis are among the best I've read. The poll numbers say that people agree on one thing. It's that America is on the wrong track. In The War State, Swanson gets to the bottom of what's ailing our society. Empire. The permanent national security bureaucracy that runs it, and the mountain of debt that has enabled our descent down this dark road. The War State could well be the book that finally brings this reality to the level of mainstream consensus. America can be saved from its government and its arms dealers. First, get the facts. Get The War State by Michael Swanson, available at your local bookseller and at Amazon.com. Or just click on the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org. Hey everybody, Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Now, you know, they publish great articles at fff.org every day, but their best stuff goes in The Future of Freedom. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 to read it online, and I got a new one coming out in September in there, U.S. Responsible for Somalia's Misery. Support FFF. Sign up for The Future of Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. And tell him Scott sent you. All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. Boy, oh boy, am I falling down on the job today, man. I just assumed I had everybody's number and everything, but I don't. That's now two guests in a row where I don't have the number. In fact, now I'm counting on my fingers to England time, and I'm hoping that I even have the right time. Did I screw up the time zone on the O'Neill interview? I might have. All right, well, this is Scott Horton show. This would be screw up number 6 on the show so far or something today, I think. But maybe Brendan O'Neill will be on the show today. I think that maybe my brain just doesn't work good enough to be a radio show host. I sure did interrupt poor Ali a lot, didn't I? I gotta do better at that. I kept thinking of things to say. You know, that was my problem. All right, well, I don't know. Man. It's too bad I didn't keep Ali Gharib on, because I was going to follow up that question if the bumper music wasn't playing, where he was saying, well, let's focus more on what America, you know, what needs to change in our relationship and forget the Israelis. Wasn't that great? I like that. Benjamin Netanyahu, he's sort of just some clown on the sidelines. He's about as meaningful as you and your show, Scott. No, he didn't say that, but Yeah, wouldn't that be nice? If Benjamin Netanyahu was as meaningless as me? I think it's one of those things where saying it makes it true, right? If everyone agrees with Ali Gharib about that, then it becomes a fact. Oh, the Israelis, who cares what they say? Yeah, all they do is lie and scaremonger and get things wrong, even when they're trying to be honest. So, forget them. That's just some crappy little Maryland-sized country full of liars and land thieves or, you know, horse rustler types over there. Who cares what they say? Why would someone be afraid of people that they say to be afraid of? I like it. That's my attitude. I mean, when the president of Iran is saying this, that, and the other thing about how he wants to make peace and he wants to make a deal, and yeah, the nuclear operation is up for negotiation, and the supreme leader has told me that I've got the free rein to go ahead and make a deal with you guys. The Israelis, all they got to say is, well, you have to give up every last atom of uranium or else it's not good enough. I don't know, man. I think you guys need some PR help. You're always, you're blowing it, I think. I think all of America agrees with Ali Gharib. Like, yeah, shut up, Netanyahu. Tell you what, go get some PR help and see if you can come up with a little bit better spin. Because otherwise, yeah, we would actually like to see our president go ahead and make a deal with the Iranians. Based on, you know, our conditions, not yours. Of course, you know me. I would just like to see Ron Paul up there saying, I have no conditions. That's it. We're not going to bomb you and we're lifting all the sanctions. And sorry to Congress who won't repeal them. I won't enforce them. That's it. Our Cold War against Iran is over. We recognize your independence. And good for you. Oh, no. And then what terrible bad thing would happen? Nothing. I guess Ron Paul probably would say something like, we would like it if you guys would stay within the non-proliferation treaty like you have this whole time. Thank you. That would be great. Okay, good. Okay, good. Got Brendan O'Neill in the email here. So, yeah, man. See if we can get him on the air. That means I gotta pick out another song to play for you. You know, I need to have Murray Rothbard queued up on my other computer. I used to have... Well, see, my computer blew up. Remember that a few weeks back? And I haven't got everything set back up yet the way it should be, but... Anyway, here's a little bit of Operation Ivy and for your ears. And then the great Brendan O'Neill from Spiked Online will be here. So give me a minute. Hey, Al Scott here. Ever wanted to help support the show and own silver at the same time? Well, a friend of mine, libertarian activist Arlo Pignatti, has invented the alternative currency with the most promise of them all. QR Silver Commodity Discs. The first ever QR code 1-ounce silver pieces. Just scan the back of one with your phone and get the instant spot price. They're perfect for saving or spending at the market. And anyone who donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate gets one. That's scotthorton.org/donate. And if you'd like to learn and order more, send them a message at commoditydiscs.com or check them out on Facebook at /commoditydiscs. And thanks. All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. Boy, that was not the Operation Ivy clip I thought it was. Oh, well. You guys like the germs too, right? All right. Well, anyway, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. On the line, we got Brendan O'Neill from Spiked Online. And I forget now. I'm sorry. I don't have it in front of me. Is it .co.uk or .com or what the hell is it? Welcome back to the show, Brendan.
Hi. It's .com.
.com. There you go. That's what I thought. SpikedOnline.com. Over there in the United Kingdom. And yes, here's the article in question. Oh, I'm sorry, I meant to say this to you off the air. I didn't have time to go back and see what all you've written since then. I only now, only this morning, am realizing that this article is a couple of weeks old. But anyway, it's really great, and you're really smart, and I was hoping that you would tell everybody the out loud version of this thing. Stop gloating, Britain. You helped to destroy Syria. And this is about not ancient history, but just in the last few years since the Arab Spring broke out. America and the United Kingdom, synonyms for each other in this instance, and the French too, I guess, their role in turning what was a genuine popular protest movement along the lines of the regime change by the people of Egypt against their American and Western-backed dictator Mubarak in 2011, and the turning of that into this horrible bloodletting that has evolved over the last 2 years. And so how's that? Could you please tell us, sir?
Yeah, well, what happened a few weeks ago, the British Parliament voted against any immediate military strike against Syria, and there was all this kind of self-congratulation in Britain, particularly amongst the kind of Labour MPs, left-wing MPs, amongst certain kind of commentators. So I wrote that piece just to say, you know, can we stop all this patting on the back? Because actually, if you look at Britain's record in relation to Syria over the past 2 years, it's been a really dangerous, destructive one. And I think people often think that Western intervention only takes the form of military strikes, but there are many forms of Western intervention, from sanctions, political blackmail, diplomatic intervention, all sorts of intervention, which can be very destabilizing. And that has proven to be the case in Syria, where our Foreign Secretary, William Hague, and your former Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, both of those two in particular, played a very important role in shifting the Arab Spring from Syria towards being a civil war. And they did that by very self-consciously declaring that Assad had no more legitimacy and effectively encouraging certain sections of the Syrian officials to break away and to set up their own force. So I think the West was quite key in pushing this over the edge.
Mm-hmm. And then can you be a little bit more specific, because you really do a great job of it in the article of going through kind of date by date. I mean, you don't have to give us exact dates, but just sort of, it was in the summer of 2011 they said this, and then the winter of 2012 they did that, and it really goes to show the stepping up of and how it is that it's the foreign intervention that has ruined everything for everybody over there.
Yeah, one of the key moments is in around July 2011, because at the beginning of 2011, people tend to forget this now, but Syria was actually quite similar to the other Arab countries in the sense that there was a popular uprising and Assad was trying to deal with it by brutal repression, but also by making concessions. So it was a similar situation as you saw in Egypt and in Libya and in other countries. But then what happens in July 2011 is that very in quick succession, first William Hague and then Hillary Clinton openly declare on the world stage that Assad is no longer legitimate, that he has lost the legitimacy to rule Syria. And Hillary Clinton in particular said something like, America no longer has any moral investment in him remaining in power. And I think these declarations, which happened very quickly in a space of a few days, what they did is they sent a green light to sections of Assad's own regime to effectively break away. So within a few days of those statements, we saw various soldiers and military commanders in Assad's camp breaking away and setting up the Free Syrian Army. So it was a really key turning point in sending a sign that Assad was not going to survive this.
Mm-hmm. And now, your best understanding here, was the MI6 and the CIA, were they telling the politicians that, oh yeah, this will be easy, don't worry about it, it'll be over in a few weeks, or what?
Well, it's hard to know what they were saying behind the scenes, but what we do know is that when the Free Syrian Army set itself up, when it broke away from Assad after these announcements from the West, we know that the West then did as much as it could to support and to arm the Free Syrian Army. We know that there were CIA officials in Turkey who were operating along the Turkish-Syrian border, where they were helping the Muslim Brotherhood and other forces to send rifles, grenades, ammunition, all sorts of things to the Free Syrian Army. We also know that Obama gave permission to an NGO in Washington to raise money for the Free Syrian Army. We know that Britain and America both sent funds to them. So what happened is that Britain and America helped the Free Syrian Army to come into existence, and then it also helped to fund it and to boost its moral authority. And it's precisely at that time that the war really deepens and it becomes far more entrenched, and the possibility of a negotiated settlement becomes more and more distant. And you can really see that in late 2011 and early 2012, when the war spikes upwards, it becomes extremely bloody. And that happens at precisely the time that various Western governments recognize the Syrian National Council as the legitimate ruler of Syria.
Mm-hmm.
And it has an immediate impact. It immediately intensifies the conflict because the opposition forces know that they have the support of the West, and Assad knows that he doesn't and that he has nothing to lose. So instantly you see this spike in the conflict and it becomes much bloodier. So I think again and again you can see how Western maneuvering on Syria, Western grandstanding on Syria, contributes to the explosion of conflict.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And of course, we've seen this even up to this week, right? One of the rebel council, whatever they call them, they've come up with new ones over and over again since they don't have any legitimacy at all. So it's kind of a thing. But anyway, they were saying just this week that whatever degree of authority they have to deal on behalf of the rebels doing the actual fighting there, they were saying, yeah, we'll deal with the Assad regime as soon as Assad is gone. That's their first step, sort of like George Bush dealing with Iran, like Ali Gharib was just describing. Yeah, as soon as you do everything we say, then we'll begin negotiations with you. That's the position of the rebels, because why not? Britain and America said so.
Exactly, and I think you're absolutely right that these forces don't have any real legitimacy apart from the legitimacy that was given to them by Clinton or Haig or the French or whoever else, as if, you know, the West has some kind of authority to decide who is the democratic representative of Syrian people. I mean, if you look at the Syrian National Council, for example, it's made up of a lot of very elite Syrian exiles, some of whom haven't been back to Syria in years. It's made up of academics. It's made up of various people who have no real connection with ordinary Syrians, but they've been hand-picked by Western officials to represent the Syrian population. And I think what happens is that the more the West says, you are the legitimate government, we are going to give you money, we are going to give you arms, it constantly encourages them to push further and further and further. And at the same time, Assad knows that if he loses, he will be dragged to The Hague. If he loses, he will be hammered by all these Western officials who have denounced him as completely illegitimate. So he hunkers down. He knows that he's got nothing to lose. So what happens is, through internationalizing the conflict, the West has really kind of taken it to another level. And I think people overlook the role of the West in turning this Arab uprising into a bloody civil war.
Yeah. Well, and The Hague, if he's lucky, might just get capped in the back of the head on the side of the road like Gaddafi.
Well, I think it's very important to look at the role that, threats from The Hague, the role that they play in conflicts, because you have lots of even Western leftists and Western radicals, people who say they are anti-war, they will often say, oh, let's not bomb them, let's just bring these people to The Hague. And I think they don't understand how much of an impact that has and how much of a weapon the ICC is, the International Criminal Court, in the armory of the West. Because what the ICC does when it makes these statements that we're going to bring you to court, we're going to try you for crimes against humanity, it directly contributes to a conflict situation by saying one side is legitimate, one side is illegitimate. It moralizes the conflict. It moralizes the conflict, and it really alienates certain parts of the conflict, which has the effect of intensifying it.
Right. It's sort of like the Rambouillet Accord, the offer you can't possibly accept, that you'll have to refuse.
Yeah, and we saw it in relation to Sudan as well, where, you know, when the ICC said that it wanted the leaders in Khartoum to be arrested and tried for crimes against humanity, there was an immediate spike in conflict, both from southern Sudan, who launched more attacks on the Khartoum government, and also in Darfur as well a few years back. So when Western lawyers and judges and these people who presume to have the authority to judge every conflict in the world, when they make those judgments, it has a real impact on the ground. So I think people of an anti-war persuasion need to be careful not just to say we don't want strikes, but also to say, well, we don't accept the authority of these Western courts to say this conflict is right and this conflict is wrong.
Right. All right, now please bear with me. We got to take this break cool. for just like a minute and a half or something. We'll be right back, all right?
Cool.
All right, everybody. It's the great Brendan O'Neill from SpikedOnline.com. Spiked-Online.com. We'll be right back after this. Hey, y'all. Scott here. The jobless rate in America keeps climbing. Food stamps and other social welfare spending continue to increase at an alarming rate. And the only thing that's kept this whole so-called recovery going at all is the Federal Reserve's inflationary printing press. Seems like 2008 might have just been a rehearsal for the financial crisis still to come. So now let me talk to you about this great video by Dr. Martin Weiss from MoneyAndMarkets.com. The video spells out how this disaster will affect you and create enormous financial opportunities if you know how to recognize a true diamond in the rough. Weiss shows when stocks have crashed and even gives the names of the biggest banks that are most likely to fail. Before you invest $1, take the time to watch this new video. Go to crisis16.com. That's crisis16.com. Learn from the experts how to evaluate these opportunities and start making better informed decisions that will lead to a better return on your investments. That's Dr. Martin Weiss at crisis16.com. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is the Scott Horton Show. Talking with Brendan O'Neill from SpikedOnline.com. And you can, of course, read his essays and other publications around the Western world on a pretty regular basis. And, of course, we're talking about the politics of Western intervention in the now Syrian civil war. Although, you know, some people, Brendan, dispute that it's even a civil war at this point. They say there's so many Saudi-backed mercenaries running around from as far as Chechnya and even Afghanistan, where we still fight against them, that really this is the whole thing is just a giant foreign intelligence agency kind of a screw job now, and the poor Syrians are all just stuck in the middle.
Yeah, I think it's a complete mess. And I think what's happened is that the conflict has been massively internationalized. So on one side, you have the West backing all these forces, some of which are very, very dodgy, as you say, jihadists, including jihadists from the West as well. You know, there's a lot of discussion about British people going over to Syria to kind of get their jihad on and to launch attacks against Assad. So on one side, you have the West backing all these kind of strange forces against Assad. And on the other side, you have Putin and Iran backing Assad up. And I think it's quite self-consciously become an international conflict. It's become an arena for the West to kind of posture against the East and for Putin to try to score some points against the West. And the problem with that is that it just ups the stakes enormously in the conflict, and it makes it less likely that it will ever come to an end because it's been so injected with external agendas and external forces and external money that the whole thing has the potential to spin out of control. So I think there's no question in my mind that the West and other outside forces are now helping to sustain this terrible conflict.
Yeah. Well, and now all this is really in the context of the Arab Spring and America's counter-revolution, really, against it, right? Co-opt the, where America backs, and Britain for that matter, back every dictator in the region, less Assad and the Ayatollah Khomeini, right? And so if we can hijack, and I guess Gaddafi was just expendable. He was one of ours, but expendable. But if they can hijack a revolution in Syria, great, at the same time that they're making sure that the kings and emirs and dictators of Arabia, you know, Bahrain and Yemen and whatever are able to crack down and save their skins no matter what.
Yeah, I mean, it's just extraordinary that anyone takes America or Britain seriously when they talk about Assad's terrible repression, when you consider that they support it in so many other parts of the Arab world. And if you just look at the West's attitude to Egypt at the moment, I mean, in Egypt, what's happening in Egypt is just extraordinary, where an elected leader was overthrown by a military coup. His supporters were massacred in their thousands on the streets, you know, unlike in Beijing, for example, where at least people stood in front of tanks and weren't immediately mown down. In Egypt, there is footage of people standing in front of tanks and being killed instantly. And these kind of actions have been implicitly supported by the West. In fact, John Kerry referred to the military coup as an attempt to restore democracy, which suggests that he doesn't have the first clue what democracy means. So, and now in Egypt, just this week, we've had the banning of the Muslim Brotherhood, a huge, massive organization which helped to bring Mohamed Morsi to power before he was thrown out, has now been banned and its finances have been frozen. So we are seeing in Egypt the severe repression of a democratic instinct, and it's explicitly backed by Tony Blair. It's implicitly backed by the European Union and Britain and America, and then they have the gall to talk about repression in Syria. So the double standards are just quite amazing.
Yeah, really, and especially when as far as I can tell from Texas anyway, the Muslim Brotherhood of Egypt are basically kind of some right-wing Republicans, conservatives. And here in Syria, we backed the suicide bombers, the most radical Islamist bin Ladenite, prisoner beheaders you could find.
Yeah, I think that's another interesting thing about the West's attitude to the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt. They talk about it as if it's this some kind of demonic, terrible bin Laden-style force, when in fact the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt is increasingly pragmatic and interested in conserving its own influence more than anything else. But as you say, in Syria, far more extreme Islamic forces are being supported by the West or are finding themselves the beneficiaries of Western funding and Western arms. And it's a repeat of history. You know, we've seen this before. We saw it in Afghanistan in the 1980s. We've seen it in other parts of the world. We've seen it, in fact, one of the great ironies, of course, is that the Muslim Brotherhood in its earliest incarnations in Egypt in the 1920s and the 1930s it came into existence largely as a result of Western sponsorship, particularly when the West was worried about radical secular forces rising up in the Arab world and threatening to take power. The Muslim Brotherhood was supported as a kind of counterblock to that. So again and again throughout history, over the past 80 or 90 years, in Israel, in Egypt, across the Middle East, we have seen the West supporting extremist Islamic forces as a block against Russian forces or Soviet forces or secular forces. And so for them now to complain about this is bizarre. And they're doing the same thing again in Syria.
Yeah. And now, when you mentioned what could happen here, I mean, that's unique and special about you, Brendan, that you're thinking more than 1 week ahead here about, say, for example, what Syria might look like after the fall of the Ba'athist regime and the execution of Bashar al-Assad. Patrick Coburn told me a year ago or something that he was afraid that we were just at the dawn of a 15-year Lebanon-style civil war of all militias against all.
Yeah, I think it could be even worse than that, amazingly, because I think at least if it were a Lebanon-style conflict, it would be contained within the borders. I mean, you know, of course, the Lebanon conflict spilt out in various ways, particularly in relation to Israel and other countries. But the key thing with Syria is that it's so intimately tied to other parts of the region, the Lebanon, for a startup, also Iran. Various parts of that region are bound up with Syria in different ways. And I think for the West to quite casually oversee the unraveling of this country is really crazy, because they don't seem to understand what the consequences could potentially be, which is could be serious regional destabilization. And it reminds me in some ways of the kind of blundering of the First World War, where you have Western forces kind of blundering about in the Middle East and redrawing maps or saying this force is legitimate and this force is illegitimate and not giving a second thought to what the consequences might be. And this is a very dangerous process.
Yeah. Well, and that's a far thing from a cry for support for Assad, but certainly you could not back the jihadists fighting him, you know?
Yeah.
Refrain from that intervention. All right, anyway, we're all out of time, I'm sorry to say, but good to talk to you again, Brendan. Really appreciate
cool.
it.
Thanks a lot, Scott.
All right, everybody. That is the great Brendan O'Neill, spikedonline.com, spiked-online.com. We'll be right back with Mark Hyden from Conservatives Concerned About the Death Penalty. Hey, y'all, Scott here, hawking stickers for the back of your truck. They've got some great ones at LibertyStickers.com. Get your son killed, Jeb Bush, 2016. FDR, no longer the worst president in American history. The National Security Agency, blackmailing your congressman since 1952. And USA, sometimes we back Al-Qaeda, sometimes we don't. And there's over 1,000 other great ones on the wars, police state, elections, the Federal Reserve, and more at LibertyStickers.com. They'll take care of all your custom printing for your band or your business at TheBumperSticker.com. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else is stickers suck. Hey y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager whose site is unique on the web. Subscribers are allowed a window into Mike's very real main account and receive announcements and explanations for all his market moves. The Federal Reserve has been inflating the money supply to finance the bank bailouts and terror war overseas. So Mike's betting on commodities, mining stocks, European markets, and other hedges against a depreciating dollar. Play along on paper or with real money, and then be your own judge of Mike's investment strategies. See what happens at WallStreetWindow.com. All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is the show. Next up is Mark Hyden from Conservatives Concerned About the Death Penalty. That's conservativesconcerned.org. I like the sound of that. It's the kind of thing that sounds like a liberal issue, but it's got conservatives right in the title. So something interesting to talk about right there from the beginning. Welcome to the show, Mark. How are you doing?
Thank you so much for having me, Scott. I'm doing great.
Well, I really appreciate you joining us here today. But here's the thing. Conservatives, they don't care about people getting sentenced to death, because the only people who get sentenced to death are poor and black or brown. In the vast majority, conservatives don't care about them. And in fact, conservatives don't care about innocent people. Witness the Iraq War and all the cries of, oh, we can't just cut and run. We got to stay there and kill everybody or else it'll get even worse. And I got to say, I'm sorry, I'm so jaded. I thought conservatives were my friends to some degree back in the 1990s. But then all the bloodlust and all the dishonesty and all the cruelty of the Bush years, and after all, he had a mandate from the American right to do what he did and to act the way he did, and they all cheered for him. So now I'm kind of wondering, what's your angle here? Because are you really concerned about Deshaun, somebody or other, being falsely convicted and sentenced to death for something?
Well, absolutely. We're a national network of conservatives and libertarians who just believe the death penalty is inconsistent with our philosophies and our principles. You're describing, I think, what stereotype people have for some conservatives. But we try to stick to our principles of pro-life policies, fiscal responsibility, and limited government. And in my personal view, the death penalty does not fall in any of those. We need to, personally, I'd like to get rid of the death penalty and have a fair system in place.
I'm sorry for coming at you so hard right off the bat here. I got a chip on my shoulder. But you know what? Let me ask you this. Are you on a speakerphone or something? Because your audio is pretty poor.
No, sir, I'm not.
You just have a regular landline, handset?
That's right.
Okay, well, I guess we'll have to make do. Let's go back to those three points there. I heard fiscal conservatism. There were two more. Sorry.
Pro-life policies.
Pro-life policy.
Government.
Yeah, well, I'll start with that.
Sure. Well, this is the death penalty is a very dangerous program that runs a very unacceptable risk of killing innocent people. If you kill one innocent person, there's no way to justify that in my book. And this is a system that has wrongly accused over 140 individuals since 1976. And they have been released because they're wrongfully convicted. Several others have been executed, even though there was serious doubt regarding their verdict. And this is a problem. This is an issue that not only conservatives are concerned about, but whether you're a liberal, a libertarian, a centrist, a statist, everybody should be concerned about innocent life. I sat down with my friend, who's the former North Carolina GOP chairman from Rutherford County, Larry Ford, and he told me, when it comes to the death penalty, there's no oops moment. There's no redos. Once you get it wrong, it's too late to right that wrong. And I think conservatives, especially that are very pro-life, are seeing this issue.
Right. Well, my favorite politician in American history, Ron Paul, said this is his one flip-flop. Of course, he's being sarcastic there. This is the one thing where he's really changed his mind. He's gone from law and order, pro-death penalty position to really just, I think, as you're saying, just a more consistent position that, you know, really, we are talking about killing somebody here, and we're talking about a government program. And even if you just, you know, kind of by instinct are biased toward trusting judges and cops and prosecutors to be decent and honest people, which is kind of funny when you say it like that. But anyway, even if you are bent that way, still, it's, you know, basically criminal justice is a socialist monopoly in America, and so therefore it has the same problems with its incentive structure, some of the same problems with its incentive structure as the post office or the army or anybody else. They fail upwards, basically.
I would agree with you, and I'd like to say that Ron Paul actually endorsed our group, and he released a statement saying that the death penalty is inconsistent with traditional conservatism and with libertarianism. So we're very happy to have his support and have his name on this. He's a thought leader, a political leader, and we're seeing more conservatives and libertarians coming out. And this limited government issue is something that they're bringing up. If you don't trust the government to fill potholes or to deliver the mail properly or have an efficient DMV, why on earth would you think that they would be able to make life and death decisions properly?
Yeah, and again, well, I don't know, again. First of all, there is the question of whether, you know, when they're trying hard, whether they can always really get it right. But then there's also, I think, and this is just, you know, again, the form of the system and the fact that it is a socialist monopoly, criminal justice, that they actually don't care very much. Like, for me, I'm a big Matlock fan. I was raised on Matlock. Unfortunately, I'm kind of extra paranoid because of it, probably. People falsely accused all the time. But on Matlock, when Matlock finally gets the guy who really did it to admit it on the stand, the prosecutor says, okay, I was wrong, sorry, drop all the charges, judge. But that doesn't ever happen in real life. It's more like, hey, we want that stricken from the record because we still want our conviction, you know? And as you pointed out on one of your pieces of propaganda I read here this morning that, you know, when you appeal, you're not even trying to say, but judge, I think I can prove I'm innocent or something. When you're appealing, the issue is whether the process was carried out fairly in the first place. So unless they really cheated you by burying some exculpatory evidence or something like that, the appeals court doesn't care whether you're innocent or not. They only care whether you were duly convicted or not.
And that's exactly what I was going to say. The appeals process is only to decide whether you had a fair trial or not. It's not there to introduce new evidence. In Texas, there was a prosecutor who was actually charged with withholding evidence. And even when you have some very blatant evidence like DNA evidence that could exonerate you, it's nearly impossible. It's incredibly difficult to enter that into the appeals process to exonerate. It's a system that the government has put into place that it's very hard to get out of if you're innocent.
And, you know, I've told this story a million times, but this will be my first time I told it to you. Back when I was a cab driver, I met a lady who was an assistant district attorney down there in Houston. And she said that their slogan was, if they really didn't do it, they'll get out on appeal. And what that meant was anyone that the cops bring in, we nail to the wall no matter what. And we do not care. We don't even question whether they really did it or really deserve it or not. Our job is to process the meat. And so in they come and out they go. And part of this is the criminalization of breathing and everything else, too, where they have so many people to prosecute. What are they going to do? Take care? They can't. It's like working at the busiest McDonald's. You just slap them burgers together and off they go.
You're right, and actually the ABA did an assessment, two-year assessment in Texas, and listed many problems with the death penalty, some of which that you're actually touching on, the prosecutorial misconduct. And this is a system that, you know, that's not the right way to look at it. These aren't pieces of meat. These are not people, or these are people that this is going to have long-lasting issues on if you wrongly convict them. And many of them have been exonerated, wrongfully convicted and released, as much as 33 years after they were convicted of a murder. So it's hard to right that wrong, is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah. Okay, now, you have a thing right there on your front page about this woman, Jennifer Thompson, you know, tearfully regretting that she pointed at the wrong guy in the trial, and she says she even carefully memorized the face of the man who raped her. She was so certain it was the right guy, and then the DNA proved that no, in fact, it was not. She had helped to convict an innocent man. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about that, because it's actually, death penalty questions aside, it's just a fascinating subject, eyewitness identification and the problems with it.
Well, that's something we see all too frequently. The death penalty doesn't generally, you don't have DNA evidence. That's only available in 5 to 10% of all criminal cases. So it's not like CSI that you see on TV. That's a farce. I mean, that's not true. That's not real life. So too often they rely on eyewitness testimony, and the mind can play tricks on you. You're not 100% sure, and many times this has happened, and it's led to some disastrous consequences. You're right.
Yeah, I remember learning in school about how, I mean, they would even, in a social psychology class, they would even have a guy run in and steal the professor's purse and run out and then ask everybody, what color was he, how long was his hair, or what color shirt was he wearing, whatever. And nobody ever agrees about anything, and they're all wrong. You know?
Well, I mean, I can add to that. I'm sure you go places and you shake hands with new people you meet, and to tell you the truth, 30 seconds after you do it, it'd be hard for me to pick that person out of a lineup.
Right. Yeah, or certainly to remember their name. And, of course, there's also the phenomenon where they remember the guy's face very well at the lineup from the picture that the cop showed them half of an hour ago and told them, this is the guy that you think it was, right? Because that's the guy that the cops think it was. And then they go into the lineup and they go, oh, yeah, there's the guy from the picture. And now, and you know what? I mean, this is true about anybody, right? We know this from taking a picture of anything. You start looking at the pictures even of yourself at a place. Those end up replacing the real memories in your brain that you saw looking out of your own eyes. Now your memories include you in the picture because you remember the picture. And that kind of thing, you know, works all the time where there he is at the trial. I remember him from the lineup and I remembered him from the picture and can't quite remember him from the crime anymore, but must be the same guy, right?
Yeah, eyewitness testimony is notoriously unreliable, and that's an issue that we run into time and time again. And if you can't be sure, you can't use the death penalty. The life is just far too important to risk to uncertain testimony.
All right, now what about I kind of mentioned there about the criminalization of everything. What about all that? Because I think, you know, first of all, and I should have said this at the beginning instead of just attacking all conservatives, I should have said at the beginning that, you know what? I don't know. Like, I try not to pay attention to this stuff because it gets me down too bad. But my wife, she loves the true crime stuff. And from time to time, I come across some of these stories about just the absolute horrors that Americans inflict on each other, that people inflict on each other, and especially some of the crimes against children. And I think often that I wouldn't mind sentencing this guy or that guy to death. Some of these serial killers and whatever, they've forfeited their right to live. Go ahead and kill them. What if we could raise the standard to beyond a shadow of a doubt somehow or something? You know, I'm no bleeding heart for the really guilty, as I'm hearing from you. You're concerned about those falsely convicted being caught up in it more than anything else. But just seems like, I don't know even what my point was anymore. It just seems like, well, I don't know. I had a question that I was getting to, but I forgot.
I would say that I'm not just worried about the wrongfully convicted. This is a system that is, like I said, inconsistent with conservatism, inconsistent with libertarianism. It costs way too much money, so there's a burden on society. Regardless of whether they're guilty or innocent, this costs much more than life without parole. In addition to that, this is a system that's put in place to supposed to help out the victim's family members. Most of them say that this is a very harmful process and it's a re-traumatizing process, so it doesn't serve them. It also fails as a deterrent, as many studies have come out and said. So it's just a failure. Conservatives, I think many of them, especially in the 80s, had this tough-on-crime mindset, and they believed that they could get it right. Well, we've seen that we have been getting it wrong. It's too expensive, risks killing innocent life, gives government too much power, and we're reexamining the position that many conservatives took. And I think conservatism is taking a different turn now. And we're part of this reexamination. There's other groups out there right on crime that know the criminal justice system as it stands now is an utter failure. It's not working, and the death penalty is the truest form of that.
Yeah. Well, and you know, too, it's very important what you say about giving the government too much power, because at least as it's supposed to be, the cops don't have any more right to shoot anybody than anybody else does, right? We're just delegating our own natural right of defense to them. They have the right to take a life only in immediate self-defense or the defense of some other innocent life. But there's no circumstance where a private citizen has the right to tie somebody down and poison them to death or electrocute them to death. And really what we're doing here is we're legalizing murder for some government employees.
Sure, and you've seen that with Carlos de Luna, who was actually probably an innocent man in Texas, and that is definitely legalized murder, what happened to him and several others. And regardless of their guilt, that is state-sanctioned killing.
Yeah. But, I mean, even for somebody who is definitely guilty of being a serial killer or something, if you shoot him, you know, in the act or something in an immediate way, that's one thing. But just killing him later because you're so mad at him or because he's so guilty just as punishment, that seems like it's murder anyway, right?
I would agree that it's incorrect. The state should not have that right.
And I don't even know who does it. Is it a doctor or a prison guard that pumps in the poison? Who gets that job?
State is going to have different policies that govern that, and they have quote-unquote professionals that oversee this. But each state is different, and you can see Georgia, my home state, actually recently they ran out of the death penalty drug, and they're having problems reacquiring it. So what they did, and this should bother anybody that believes in small government or transparency in government, they've passed laws to say it's a state secret what drugs we get, where we get them. So we don't actually know what they're doing or what those processes are in Georgia, and it's being challenged right now, and that should scare anybody.
Yeah. It's crazy. You know, I think even in assuming that they have all of the very best poisons for the way that they do the needle, it seems like they kill them while they're awake kind of thing, right? They don't knock you out with, you know, say like a whole lot of morphine and put you to sleep and then kill you. They kill you while you're awake, right? And that's the official thing.
I would say there's no such thing as a best poison, so I would disagree with that. But yes, I mean, they start off awake. I thankfully have never personally witnessed it. I think it's very macabre and disgusting to even do that. So I have talked to some workers in the corrections facilities as well as wardens who have overseen this, and they say it's a very terrifying experience.
Yeah. You know, I remember seeing a documentary one time about a guy who he was basically a death penalty entrepreneur, and he rationalized it that, you know, I mean, he felt kind of bad about it, that what he was participating in, but what had happened was he had found out just how completely sloppy and amateurish and kind of slapped together the death penalty was, or the way it was carried out in state after state after state. And so he was like, hey, listen, if you guys are going to electrocute somebody to death, let's make sure we really do it right and quick and not, you know, make it take a half an hour. And you know what I mean? This kind of thing. And so in the telling his story about all of the different innovations of the way to kill people for the death chambers that he had, it really came out just how, you know, really, if you ask seven guards to come up with a way to execute somebody, that was basically the way it was in this state, this state, and this state. You know, totally
sure.
What you would not imagine from seeing it on TV or something.
Sure, and Ron McAndrew was actually a warden in the state of Florida who is now opposed to the death penalty, but he oversaw 11 executions. One was the electric chair when the person actually caught on fire. So it's a very terrifying and terrible experience, not only for the victim, but for the people witnessing it as well. And I believe this has actually caused some post-traumatic stress for Mr. McAndrew, and he has become a very outspoken supporter of what we're doing.
Yeah, that's good. And now... I think you mentioned that the that only 5% of death penalty cases are based on DNA evidence?
No, only 5 to 10% of criminal cases in general even have DNA available in the case. So I mean, most of these cases don't rely on that. They rely on eyewitness testimony and other forensics that oftentimes are found to be false, like hair analysis. The FBI is actually doing an analysis of multiple death penalty cases, some of which have already been carried out, where they used faulty forensic science, bunk science, to kill people.
Right. I mean, they've had some really, some pretty massive scandals when it comes to these crime labs, right?
Absolutely. And I have to applaud the FBI and the State Department, because what they actually said was, we probably made mistakes. We can't right the wrong, but we're going to find out what went wrong, and they're going to publicize it. And I think that's a step in the right direction. Personally, I think we should get rid of the death penalty, but that is showing at least some humility in government, saying we do make mistakes, and we make mistakes in the worst kinds of ways.
Yeah. Well, and on your site, you talk about, is it Todd Willingham? Is that how you say it?
Yes.
I forget. I don't have it in front of me, but where he was convicted and sentenced to death and executed by the state of Texas based on the testimony of fire experts, which was later disputed by other apparently better fire experts about whether, and I've heard quite a few cases like this too. There was, in fact, the Innocence Project was working on one where a lady was convicted of killing her own kid in a trailer fire, and she was finally released when exculpatory evidence was raised in her case. But this is the kind of thing where, I guess, because of the TV shows, people just put so much trust in, well, if the scientist on the stand says so, well, then that's just absolutely unimpeachable evidence against somebody, and where it's really just not so, like you're saying. And you don't even have to have corruption in your crime lab, but you can just still have a fingerprint artist basically acting as though they're a real hard scientist, that what they say is 100% factual, when what it really is it's an interpretation.
Absolutely. And I would like to say that I think most of these people have the best of intentions, but like you said, it's more of an art. It's not a science for many of these forensics, quote-unquote experts. They get it wrong, and we're finding out that the science, the quote science that they're relying on, is oftentimes wrong. As the case with Todd Willingham, it looked like the initial fire expert was entirely wrong, and that was the reason that this man was executed.
Right. Oh, and I'm sorry that I spaced out earlier, but I remember what I was trying to get to before when I went off on that tangent. That question was the over-criminalization of everything, which means that, and especially with the war on drugs, and where simple drug possession charges clog the entire court system, so that if you were a judge or if you were a prosecutor, you really don't have a choice in life but to plea bargain all day, threaten people with a giant stack of charges so they have to plead to something, where, I mean, really, trial by plea bargain has replaced trial by jury, because you just couldn't have, and because, of course, it's not a capitalist system where you have as many judges as you need because the market provides. It's a socialist system where you don't have enough judges. And it's always, there are not enough courtrooms to deal with all the cases. Everything is all backed up, and so people don't even really have as much of a chance to fight when it comes to the kinds of things that really are the government's business, like prosecuting murder cases, you know?
Sure,
doing it right.
The death penalty, just like any other, but much worse, clog up the system. You can look in California, and frequently they're having people, inmates that are waiting on the death penalty, dying of old age. This is a process that takes decades. Many of them have been waiting for 40 years. So this is a process that does clog it up. Now, you talked about plea bargaining. I would like to say that oftentimes we've seen, especially in younger kids or people that are a little ignorant when it comes to the criminal justice process, they're threatened with the death penalty and said, we know you did it. You're going to get the death penalty if you don't admit it to us. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes they're innocent and they've admitted to it, and it takes decades for them to be exonerated because they're wrongfully convicted.
Sure. Well, and then, of course, in all the death penalty states, which I don't know how many aren't these days, are there any states that are no longer death penalty states right now?
32 states have the death penalty still.
32, okay. And then in, I guess, all those, that's part of the jury questioning, is you got to be pro-death penalty to even get on the jury in a capital case, which means that you're going to be that much more biased toward the prosecution in the first place before the thing even gets started.
That's right. You cannot serve on a capital jury unless you support the death penalty. And that's another process the government has put in there, which is unfair. How is that a jury of your peers? There's a framework that the government has put in here that's very pro-death penalty. And let's not forget, many people say, well, it's the jury that actually decides whether or not they get the death penalty, but it's the government that actually decides whether or not they're going to seek the death penalty. And then they've got this framework in to make it more attainable, and then they've got an appeals process to make it incredibly hard to reintroduce new evidence.
Right. Okay, now tell us very quickly what all you're doing about it and how people can join up with your effort here. It's, again, conservativesconcerned.org.
Well, we have several state groups that are getting involved and creating their own chapters. If you want to get involved in the state level, please pop me an email, info@conservativesconcerned.org, or you can stay in touch by signing up online at conservativesconcerned.org. And we're also going to a lot of conferences. We'll be at CPAC St. Louis this weekend. I'd be happy if you would come by and see us, shake our hands, see us at our booth. But other than that, we're just trying to shatter the myth that conservatives support the death penalty and provide a forum for conservatives and libertarians to get together and discuss this issue and express their concerns.
Yeah, right on. Well, I think it's a great mission, and I, of course, completely agree with you about this. Well, I don't know completely. I guess maybe I'm worse on this issue than you are. I still have a soft spot for the death penalty in some cases. But I agree with you that there's no way to let the government carry it out in any fair or effective way, and that it's, well, I don't think there should be a government at all. How could I think that they have the right to put anybody to death? But
when I was at LPAC, I believe one person who came up to our booth said it best when he said, "I can sum up the death penalty in one word, and it's oops, because the government is defined by Murphy's Law."
By Murphy's Law?
Yes. What can go wrong will go wrong.
Right. And it's true. And you know what? As you were saying, the evidence bears this out. It has gone wrong over and over and over again. So it's certainly true. All the evidence is there. And, you know, it's sort of like the foreign policy in a way, isn't it, Mark, where you kind of have your imagination of how it works, and then there's how it really works. And once you break away from the kind of, you know, law and order TV narrative of how it works and get to the real world, then you realize that this is not the right thing at all. Something's got to be done about this.
Right. The death penalty is broken like many other government programs, and it doesn't work like it works on TV. Men are fallible, and the government multiplies that fallibility.
Yep. All right. Well, thanks very much for your efforts and for your time on the show, Mark. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Scott.
All right. And I'm sorry to Mark and to all you conservatives out there for calling y'all a bunch of bloodthirsty, innocent death mongers. I like conservatives a lot of the time, and I shouldn't be so hard on you, but you know what? The Bush years, they were some bad years for conservatism. They were the years where conservatives abandoned all conservative principles in order to support their favorite government. You know, like a bunch of Obama bots. And so there's still a lot of bad blood there, you know? But anyway, I'm trying to get over it. It's 5 years into the rule of the Democrats now, so I'm trying to get over it. I'm trying to welcome the right to morality. Yeah, murder is wrong, even if a judge is the murderer. I know you love judges, but that guy's right that sometimes judges kill the wrong guys. All right, anyway. I'm not very good at radio, but I am right about everything. Thanks for listening, y'all. See you tomorrow.